I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
And that same elementary school teacher called me up and said that he had read in like the Chicago Sun-Times or the Tribune, one of the major Chicago papers, that Joanna Merlin, who was an actress and a casting director for Harold Prince, was going to be in Chicago during my Christmas break. And they were having this open call for the next Hal Prince Steve Sondheim musical. And he was like, you should forget going to Puerto Rico and you should come and do this open call. And I was like, a cattle call, really? And he said, you should.
Hello, world, and welcome back to another episode of Thanks for Coming In. I'm your host, Jillian Clare. If this is your first time tuning in, this is a show where I speak to fellow actors about their journey in the industry and I make them share a couple bad audition stories with me. If you're not already subscribed to the show, make sure to hit that subscribe button right now and leave us some love. Today on the show, we have a Tony Award-winning actress. She's also a director, a writer, an author, just about everything you can be. You may remember her from Women of the Movement, Madam Secretary, Fear the Walking Dead, Gotham. It is the incredible Tanya Pinkins. And welcome to the show, Tanya.
Thank you, Jillian. So happy to be here talking with you.
I'm so excited to have you. Tony Award winning. I mean, so fun. I have so much to talk to you about. But before we get into all of the amazing things that you've done in your career, I have to ask you, what made you decide to be an actor?
You know, I wish I could say that it was a decision. I don't think I decided to be an actor until I was in my 40s. I think more than anything, I was trying to not be an actor. I was constantly quitting. But I did have an elementary school teacher who did acting on the side, and he took a lot of classes. And he would have us do Broadway type musicals, and he'd rent all the costumes when I was in elementary school. So I got to do Anna and the King and I and Golda and Huddle in Fiddler on the Roof and Annie and the Miracle Worker. And so I would say that it was him who got me my first agent and would take me to auditions. So that would be how I got to be an actor. But I've quit and tried not to be one a lot.
I feel like that's the story of every actor. We're always just like, oh man, sometimes it really hits you hard and you're like, okay, I need to take a break and find something different.
Yeah.
So you said that's how you got in. How did you find your way into the professional avenue of acting? Did you go to college for it, or was it all just kind of happenstance?
No, it really was with this teacher. I mean, from the time I was about 12 or 13, he got me my first agent, which I'm trying to think who it was. Gosh, I see her face. and I can't remember, but she was a former Ford model in Chicago, and she'd started her own agency. So I started doing commercials and print work and industrial films when I was about 12 or 13 years old.
Wow. You've been in the business for a long time. I love it.
For a long time.
Your whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Do you remember what, like, the first big film or TV role that you got when you were an adult was?
First big film or TV. Well, my first feature film was Beat Street. Which was one of the first films that was made about the hip-hop world and the Bronx and the South Bronx, the dance, the graffiti. So that was produced by Harry Belafonte and David Picker.
And oh, Ray no Don big Chalmers deal.
Was the star of that. So that was my first big feature. And then I'd say my first big television role was on As the World Turns as Heather Dalton, where I was working with Meg Ryan, Stephen Weber, Marissa Tomei, Julianne Moore. We were the kids on As the World Turns.
Oh my gosh, what a lineup.
Now I think my first film, though, my first tiny role was as a very small part in Damien Omen 2, which was filming in Lake Forest, Chicago.
Omen 2, as in the scary little kid? Oh no! Terrifying.
I love horror movies.
I do too. They're like my guilty pleasure. I love bad horror movies too. Like the ones that are just so off the wall strange. I love watching them. I think they're so fun.
Have you seen my horror movie?
I don't think so.
I wrote, produced, and directed a horror film called Red Pill. It's on Amazon.
Well, I'm watching
and,
it.
And yeah.
Tell me about
Blades
that.
Is in it. Colby Menifee is in it. Catherine Curtin, Catherine Irby. Yeah, I have a horror film.
Okay, so you wrote and directed and produced. I mean, was that your first time doing all that?
I did all the jobs because I didn't have a lot of money and I didn't have a lot of time. And I did all the jobs. Like at the end, when you see the credits, you'll see my name and my child's name, you know, 10 or 12 times.
I love that. But you know what? Sometimes that's what you got to do to make the film that you want to make.
To make a film at all.
Yes. To make a film.
That's what you got to do.
I'd love to talk to you about your early Broadway experience and how you got yourself into that world, because that's a difficult, difficult feat to even make it to Broadway, let alone win a Tony Award.
Well, you know, my road there is, wasn't, you know, it's such an unusual thing that happened. I was in my freshman year at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and I was planning to spend my Christmas break in Puerto Rico, and that same elementary school teacher called me up and said that he had read in like the Chicago Sun-Times or the Tribune, one of the major Chicago papers, that Joanna Merlin, who was an actress and a casting director for Harold Prince, was going to be in Chicago during my Christmas break, and they were having this open call for the next Hal Prince Steve Sondheim musical. And he was like, you should forget going to Puerto Rico and you should come and do this open call. And I was like, a cattle call, really? And he said, you should. And I did. And I went and saw Joanna and read for her. And I remember at the end of the day of auditioning, she said, I'd like to take you to New York to audition for Hal and Steve. And so during that same break, they flew me to New York and put me up. And I auditioned for Hal and Steve with a lot of other people, Giancarlo Esposito and, Lonnie Price.
Wow.
James Alexander. And we all auditioned. And at the end of the day, they said, you know, congratulations. We would like you to be in the show. We won't start work until next fall, but you are hired.
Oh my gosh. Right there in the room.
Right there in the room.
That's remarkable. I mean, that There's rarely an audition happens.
For you right there.
There's one right there. I mean, that rarely happens. And for it to happen with a Broadway show too. I mean, I feel like Broadway shows, it's like 20 different callbacks of try this, do this, and figure this out, and here's the dance, here's the singing. I mean, it's usually so long, like such a big process.
You know, I think there was something I figured out very early in my career. Remember, I've been doing this for almost 50 years. That, you know, I remember when I first came to New York and people would have me audition for like 20 minutes. They would have me sing all kinds of songs, just sing all the things I was capable of doing, even though they were only going to have me do this very small, limited thing. Mm. And I think after a while of doing all that prepping, I just finally found, like, these are some songs I do well. These are some things I do well. And that became what I did. No matter what they were asking for, I would go in and show you what I do well, rather than trying to go in and show you that I can do what you want to do. My focus began on, I want to be able to do the things that I can do well. And so that's what I'm going to show you.
Mm. That brings me to, I've been asking actors this recently because I find it fascinating. I want to know, when you get a script for an audition or a callback or whatever it is, how do you break it down? Do you have your own method? Do you pull from multiple methods?
I would say I pull from multiple methods. One thing is that sometimes I just read a script and it speaks to me, like the emotion is there as I'm reading it. Mm. And that's a real great gift. When the material, you just respond to it instinctually. I studied many methods with many teachers, but the Meisner method of figuring out what do I want, what's in my way, what are the different tactics I'm going to use to try to get it? That is something I do. I always look for what is happening at the beginning of the script and what is, or the scene rather, and what is happening at the end. A number of my casting director friends have said that they want to see a change. Like every scene should have a change. If it started off happy, it's got to end sad or vice versa, but that they're looking to see an arc. They're looking to see how a character evolves or what changes in the action. And then I worked with a man named Tim Phillips who has a wonderful book called Audition for Your Career, Not the Job. And I think that that really reflects the fact that I decided early in my career that I'm going to audition with what I do well. And if you're not looking for the thing that I do well, it's probably not the right job for me. Tim Phillips has a method he calls Sherlock Holmesing the text. And some of the brilliance of that is he talks about, you know, the detail that film and television writers take with making sure every word on the page is exactly what they mean. So particularly with television and film, he has you go word by word and tell you, what is that word telling you? Specifically names. What is the meaning of the name? You know, what is the origin of a name? Because that's telling you something about the character. that a lot of television people use names to keep certain qualities in their mind. So if you take the time to look at the etymology of a name, you may find it some hints into the character. So those are some of the techniques that I use when I'm working on material.
I mean, those all sound fantastic. I'm a Meisner girl myself, and I love the way he breaks things down, and I love that you can go into any Meisner class anywhere in the world and you're going to be able to find people who you connect with and that you can immediately say, hey, you want to do some repetition? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. I mean, it's so nice to have that that sort of community around acting.
It is. Now, since I'm an old Meisner person, like I said, I've been doing it. I first started studying in the method when I was 15 years old. So I've also taught it. I've taught it at universities. And one of the sort of things I've had to watch in how some people teach the Meisner method is a lot of eye fucking. I don't know if I can say that word, but
you can
people
say
like
it.
Do this. They act like this. And they forget that it's about responding, and you don't have to see to respond. You can respond from a sound. What I love about it is I always say to people that if my other partners are good, they're going to give me my performance. I'm just going to, you know, have done all my prep work. I show up and I put my attention on you and I just respond authentically, and that's going to give me a performance.
It's so true. I mean, if the other people are prepared and ready and good, then you're going to be good too. Because I mean, that is everything. My acting teacher, when I was a small child, started teaching me Meisner. I had no idea that it was Meisner until I got into a Meisner class as a teen. And I was like, wait a second, this is all very familiar. But she always used to say, acting is reacting. And if you're not just listening and figuring out what that person is going through and feeling, then you're not doing your job as an actor.
Agreed.
We're going to take a quick commercial break and then we'll be right back.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
And back to the show. So you've been on several amazing TV shows over the years. Several. I mean, you have Fear the Walking Dead, Madam Secretary, Gotham, as just a few of them. I want to know what role to you in the TV world really spoke to you and was the most fulfilling as an artist?
Well, I've had a lot of them. So I think I started working with Tim Phillips in about the fall of 2016, and he has some amazing Meisner-based technique for film. And so I had been cast in Gotham as Ethel Peabody, and I didn't have very much to do. But using some of Tim's tools about how to be very full when you're on stage and have no on screen and have no lines, I think that that technique, combined with Beatty Wong, who played Dr. Strange.
Love Beatty Wong.
Yeah, love Beatty. Beatty and I, you know, decided we were going to create a relationship on camera that the writers hadn't written. We were going to create it, and we were going to create it out of just how we reacted to each other, because there weren't really lines. And so I had been brought in to do 4 episodes, and I ended up doing, I think, 12.
I mean.
So that one is I feel very good about that one, because that was where I truly saw my efforts, you know, reap me a reward of getting more opportunities. And it really was, sometimes the camera people would be like, man, whatever was going on in your mind, I couldn't take my eyes off of you.
Yes. Captivating the cameraman is always like the best feeling, because you're like, oh, did I stump you?
And then that can be troublesome, because I think from having that Meisner training, I'm always interesting. And I have had directors say, would you stop whatever you're doing? And I'm just listening.
Yeah.
You know, it can be very upsetting. I actually had a wonderful director. She said to me, she said, you are so interesting on camera. You just need to be a star. But this is not you're not the star of this movie. And she said, I can't have you on camera with my leads, because I only want to watch you.
Wow. I mean, I feel like that's a credit to how well you're prepared, though. I mean, sucks, but but I mean, that's such a compliment. And clearly now we need to make you a star.
Okay, I'm ready. I've been waiting.
Talk to me a little bit about the show Women of the Movement that you were on. It came out, was it earlier this year or last year at this point?
January this year. You know, there's so many different Hollywood cliques, and I'm not in any of them. And an actress fell out of a show. It was actually Niecy Nash was supposed to do that role, and they lost her. And they were going to start shooting on, I think, Monday, something like about January 6th,
Oh, my gosh.
21, that was the day I flew, I remember. And they needed to hire someone quick. And I think for many of the reputations I have a reputation for being really good and really fast and able to handle text and emotion. And so I think I auditioned on like December 30th and got that job on December 31st and, you know, knew I had to fly a few days later.
Wow.
probably emotionally the most difficult piece I've ever done. We spent 3 months down in Mississippi, a place I said I was never, ever going to even visit. But I was down there. My family's from Mississippi. I found some relatives. And I, I lived in Mississippi for three years. And it taught me a lot about what is America and the fact that for me, living in major cities like Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, that is not the majority of America. People don't live the way I live.
Which is an important thing to know as an actor. I mean, that show was, it was so heavy to watch. And I'm wondering how it was on set. I mean, were you able to keep your spirits up together in between takes, or did it feel as heavy as it did for viewers?
Oh, it was heavy. They had psychologists there for certain days, you know, available for people. But when we had to play the scenes, you had to stay in that. You just had to stay in that. And it's, you know, quite frankly, I can't imagine anything worse than, you know, having your child die. You know, parents don't want to ever live beyond their children. And it was my grandchild who, in many ways, I had raised because Mamie was a young mother. So it was the worst possible thing that I could imagine having to do. Because even once, well, I have to save that for my audition story.
Last question about this, because I think it was such an important show. I want to know, and I want younger actors to be able to listen to this too. I want to know how you were able to not take it home, or did you take it home?
Say that again.
I was wondering if you were able to leave the heaviness on set and not take it home with you, or if it still burdened you, you know, when you were away from everyone else.
Just auditioning for that part, I carried that heaviness for the whole day. And I thought, you know, when I first became an actress, I always was looking for the really emotional roles. And after auditioning for that, I was like, maybe I'm not an actor anymore. This doesn't feel good.
Wow.
I can't let this go. And so when they called me about the callback, I was both happy, but I was like, oh. And, you know, for the original audition, I didn't even think I had a shot. I said yes to the audition because I was getting to audition with Gina Prince Blythewood, who is, you know, this brilliant writer, director, showrunner. And, you know, I wasn't even trying to get the part. I was like, I get to be on a Zoom during the pandemic with Gina Prince Blythewood? Of course. So, of course, when they said callback, I was like, ugh. I need to like shoot my shot one time and be done with it. And one of my teachers, William Esper, God rest his soul, he used to say that a good technique for any kind of audition was to always have something planned for yourself after the audition. Because he said the energy of looking forward to something after will carry. I don't know if you've ever watched those tapes of people walking into the room, but they often say that people get the audition by how they walk into the room. Like you walk into the room like you're going to get something. So he said, having something prepared for when you, after the audition, you know, has this little twinkly mystery. And people are like, well, you know, what is that little secret they have? So that is a technique that I've often used with auditions. For this one, I was like, they're going to get one shot. I'm going to let myself go all the way there. So I remember, you know, I got my lighting all set up. I put my X's on the computer monitor for the different characters. I really prepped it and prepared it. And it was like, we're gonna just go there and then we're going to be done. And then I have something fun to do. And so, you know, they asked me if I was ready. I said, yes. I shot my wad and the showrunner goes, oh, can we do it again? I forgot to tell my family not to walk through the room.
Oh, my gosh.
I was like, sure. But I shot my wad. And we did it again. And thank God it was all videoed, you know, the Zoom video. Yeah. So they had both takes.
Wow. And then you booked it. Well, I was going to ask you to share an audition story, but is that the story?
Now.
You have. So you're working on a new play right now. Is that right?
Just finished doing A Raisin in the Sun, which is a classic play from 1959. It was on Broadway, but we did a different version of it than had been done in New York. We did the entire play that Lorraine Hansberry wrote, which included another character, a neighbor.
Really? I didn't know there was an alternate version. And then before we go here, I do want to talk to you about Red Pill. I know we talked about it a little bit before, but I want to know what it was like for you to handle all those roles and also if you're going to do it again.
Jillian, it was like, this is what I was born to do.
Yes.
I wish I had become a millionaire early so that I could have just made movies over and over again. I loved it so much. I never worked so hard in my life for so many years, and it was so worth it because it was mine. Mm. You know, we as actors are really other people's tools. You know, we come in and we gift them with our skills and help them bring their vision to life, and then we walk away and they have this castle that we've built for them. This was one of the first times that I got to build my own castle, and it was thrilling. And, you know, I currently have options on like 3 other projects, and yes, I want to do it again and again and again and again and again because I loved it.
Oh, I love that. Yes. We love to see it. We need more women behind the camera. I love this. And I was going to ask you, what's next? So what's next? You got these options.
Right. Well, I'm, you know, shopping a series that I adapted from a bunch of Angels and Demons novels. So trying to find somebody to take that on. I have 2 film scripts. One I'm doing a rewrite of and looking to raise money for those myself. One of the things I learned making my own film is that a film is a piece of real estate, and it makes money for whoever owns it for as long as storytelling is out there and people are looking to have a story. So if you can be fortunate enough to maintain ownership of the film and only license it to other people for their use, then that is something that you and your descendants can continue to capitalize on forever. So learning to raise money, which is a very different journey, and I don't know how, haven't done it yet, but it's very different than just signing with a studio where they hire you like an actor, and they make the movie and you're hired to do this, and then they can fire you or they're done with you, but they own it forever. Mm-hmm. So really trying to learn that new skill.
Wow. Well, you got a lot on your plate. And we love to see it. We love to see a working woman busy. Do you have social media so people can follow you and see all of your stuff?
Yeah, at Tanya Pinkins for Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Also, Red Pill has a game. Ooh. So if you go to the Red Pill movie website, there's a narrative game to see if you can survive a world of Red Pills. And I also did a book called Red Pill Unmasked, which is available on Audible, and it's also available as an ebook on the website, which really gives you the details into the making of the film from idea all the way through, you know, promotion and getting it out into the world.
Wow. Actor, writer, director, author, professor. Well, I mean, what don't you do? Do you sleep?
I am fortunate to be one of those people who do not need a lot of sleep. So I probably sleep 4 or 5 hours a day. If I need a nap, like I just woke up from a nap before we were talking, I take a nap. But I I am very comfortable doing more than one thing at a time. Like I'll be watching TV and reading a book or doing something else. And I always have multiple projects in my mind at the same time. I remember I was talking to this guy who built, his company's called like Liminal something, but he built a whole system for people to do plays on Zoom during the the pandemic. And Andy Carlucci is his name. And I asked him, like, he's so smart in his brain. And I'm like, Andy, tell me what it's like inside your head. And I thought in many ways, I'm not as, you know, wow, brilliant as he is. But he described that it was like he was standing in the middle of a round table around him, or a series of tables. And on every table was a puzzle. And he would, you know, go up to one table and do as much of that puzzle as he could. And if he couldn't finish it, he'd move to the next table and, you know, solve as much of that. And then when he solved that puzzle, that table would go away and a new one would come up. And that's kind of how I think my mind works. There's always a whole lot of puzzles and ideas and projects that I'm working on. And I give a little attention to many of them every day. And then I have my downtime, which isn't really downtime because I love to binge watch a series on TV. But that's like study for me.
Exactly.
Like I'm learning how people are doing things. What's you know, because storytelling is changing all the time. And with the streamers and the fact that you can binge, the fact that now we have stories that move in and out of time. So, like you could be moving 50, 60 years last night, 30 years ago, last week,
yeah.
You know, so there's a whole new kind of storytelling going on.
That's amazing. Well, I can't wait to see all of the puzzle pieces put together on all of your new projects so that we can all enjoy them. And it was so lovely talking to you. I hope to have you back when one of those puzzles is out in the world.
Sounds good. I like it. I'll be back for my next film.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jillian. You have a great day.
Thanks again to Tanya for coming on the show and spending some time with me. Make sure to check out her film, Red Pill, wherever you get your films. Tune in next week for another fantastic episode with a very special Christmas guest. And as always, thanks for coming in.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.